Okay, let us begin. As always, a few initial preliminary comments. We've talked a great deal about Lithuania and the changes. I know Yisrael, who's on with us, has often asked about that. So I'm going to show you something now. I hope you're all sitting down. I don't know if you're going to want to do Kriya after seeing this, or if it'll disgust you. I don't know what to say, but this will show you better than anything else how different Lithuania is today, by which I mean B'nai Brak, than what, not just what it was in the old country, but what it was even 20 years ago. It was unimaginable even 20 years ago. See what I'm going to show you right now on the screen. Spoke about holy wine in the past. What you have here? The son of a great sage from the Chazon Ish's family, himself a great sage. This is not a question of some entrepreneur just doing something without his knowledge. Based upon what I've been able to determine, he gives his permission for this. He doesn't bless the wine or anything like that. It comes from his shiraim. What are shiraim? When Hasidic Sherebis eat, I've been to a tish, if you've ever been to it and you're not a chassid, it'll really turn your stomach. The leftovers, the bones of the chicken and things like that, the Hasidim grab and they eat it because they think there's some sort of holiness in it. Here you have a Litvish Rav giving out shiraim, holy wine, things like that. And a friend of mine called up this number, and while he was waiting, there was someone else on the other line, a woman, asking all sorts of questions. This would have been not just incomprehensible in Lithuania, it would have been incomprehensible 20 years ago. They would have laughed at this. I think the traditional Lithuanian still laughs at this, but I don't know how they can laugh at it anymore, because if their leader is involved with this, then all of a sudden it becomes acceptable. In fact, my friend, I'm not going to mention his name because he might not want his humor to get out. He's a Rav and a scholar in Israel. He said, now that we've seen Litvish Rabbanim doing this, which is a miracle, because no one in their right mind ever could have imagined this, we have to now wait for the next miracle, which is a Hasidic Rebbe writing an important work of Chidushim on Shas. That's a bit of a crude misnagdish comment, because the truth is we do have Hasidic Rebbes who have written things. But that's about as shocking as it can get, I think, from Chaim Konevsky there. And his wife, the daughter of Rav Yoshev, saying that this wine brings all sorts of shuos, healing or wonderful things. So take that in. Now, having said that, let me show you another Litvish Gadol who never would be caught dead with anything like that, because it's a coincidence, or Hashgacha Pratis, call it what you will. We spoke last class. I went over the stuff about the Birkat HaMinim, and coincidentally, I was reading this week this Sefer. It came out a few years ago about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. And on page 50 and 51, it tells us that he did not say the brach, the nusach, v'lam al-shinim, because he knew it was a fake nusach and due to the censor. And after investigating it, he found, he on his own realized there was a problem, and he found that it's the proper blessing, like the Yemenites have, Amashimadi Malti Tikva V'chol Aminim Kuredi Avedu, and that's what he said. If you recall, I mentioned that it's quite strange that here we know what the proper Nusach is, and yet no one's bothered to change it. Have people today saying the verse Sheheni Shachavim. In fact, I heard last night at this dinner I was at that in the new Sack Sitter, which is published in America, the verse Sheheni Shachavim, which appears even in the Art Scroll in brackets, appears not within brackets. And when Jonathan Sacks was asked about it, he said it was without his knowledge, because he himself does not believe this verse should be said, because it's a reflection of previous views of Gentiles that he doesn't advocate today. So there's a whole story to this, but people are willing to put that in, but for some reason we still continue saying V'lam al-shinim three times a day, and it's a false text. But Rav Yaakov wouldn't say the false text. A couple more points before we start. Here is a book. could see it that clearly. Daniel Sperber's Pathways in Halakha, Pathway in Halakha, which is his justification for women being given aliyos. It's being translated into English, supposed to appear within the next 2 weeks. I really hadn't looked at it carefully until the last week, and lo and behold, I found something that relates to things we spoke about. Think back to the classes on Rav Yitzhak Nissim, and we spoke about probably the most learned Jewish woman of the 20th century, Flora Sassoon. There's a lot of talk now about learned Jewish women, Maharats, Rabbahs, all this. Flora Sassoon was far and away of the Rabbahs in the 20th century. Yeah. But I want to, and we spoke about her close connection to Rav Nissim and the Ben Ish Chai, but I want to read you something he quotes from in this book. This is on page 32, about when Flora Sassoon returned to Baghdad, one of her trips. Talks about how they were obviously received by dignitaries. Flora was honored as much for her piety and scholarship as her name. She was given the rare privilege of reading the Torah in the synagogue. No woman had for centuries been allowed to leave the curtain gallery during service. Flora read from the very scrolls dedicated long ago by Sheikh Sassoon. And as Sperber says, you have to assume that since Flora Sassoon was so well known, and it was a big deal when she came, the Ben Ish Chai must have known about that. I don't know. But here we have Flora Sassoon, not just being given Malia, reading the Torah in Baghdad, which was hardly a modern Orthodox YCT-oriented show. If I knew about that, when we spoke about Rav Nissim, I would have mentioned it then. A couple more points. A number of you found it interesting. It's dealt with Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan and the practices of the masses, Kabbalistic type practices, funeral practices. So anyone who's interested further, you can go to HebrewBooks.org. There's a book called Siach Kohen by Rabbi Elazar Kohen. Not an important figure. I don't know really anything about him. But if you look in Yoredeya number 6, he discusses the practice in certain Sparta communities at a funeral for ignorant people. He describes it mostly as the women. Would actually, they do this in Islamic countries, if I'm not mistaken, would cut themselves as a sign of mourning. You know, we know about the practice of tattoos as a sign of mourning. That's, according to Ibn Ezra, that's the whole pshat of what the issue is with tattoos. The question is this forbidden? Do you have to rebuke them? And he actually concludes that they're not going to listen to you anyway. This is their practice. Let the ignorant continue what they're doing. I mention this only because this is another example where if you told someone in our community that there's a notion of Jews going and cutting themselves for a dead person, they would think you're off the wall. And finally, one more point. If you recall, when we dealt with Rishon Moshe Chazan and his trip to London, I told you about how there was an early reform practice of not calling people up Aliyahs by their names. In fact, if you go to HebrewBooks.org, you'll see there's two volumes, one called Divrei Menachem and one called Divrei Yigeret by Mendel Steinhardt. He was a traditional Talmud Chacham, but he got caught up with the Reform movement, the early Reform movement. And he wrote responsa, for example, he got rid of Kitnios, and he wrote other responsa with a reformist sentiment. And in Divrei Yigeret, Volume 3, one of his reforms, by the way, number 3. If you look at number 4, he permits singing songs in the vernacular, and he quotes the Rambam we dealt with, that only fools think that it's a problem singing in the vernacular. Again, try in our shul singing songs. I think it's a gospel church or something. But in number 3, he talks about, and quotes Rishonim, that this is a fine practice to call people up just by pointing to them or something like that. And he says that these days it creates all sort of machlokas, because some people want to be called Morenu, others want to be given other titles. Okay, so you could say that's a reformer. And that's what I always thought. And then I picked up this book a couple weeks ago, Shelos Tshuvos HaRav HaRashi, Rechael Yahu, responsa he wrote when he was chief rabbi, and in the year 1988-1989. And in, on page 520, he's asked a question about the synagogue. They created a new practice here where they don't call people up by their name. They simply call them Rishon Sheni. And they say that there's a great advantage in this because the Gabbai doesn't need to run around asking everyone their names and forget about it. And the rabbi of the shul thought that this is a bad practice, that you have to call people up by their names. So therefore, they turned to Rabbi Eliyahu to ask him what he thinks. And his reply is that it is true. There is a practice, he quotes Tchida, not to call the people up by their names, because maybe the person doesn't want to come up to the Torah, but rather they would bring him a little card or something which would have tell him, you get the first Aliyah, you get the second Aliyah. So you see, this isn't really a reformist thing. It goes back. Not that we're thinking of instituting it, though. Okay. Let us continue. We will... this is the last class we're going to be having on Rav Henkin. We'll finish up, and we will be starting soon with Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz. We ended last class talking about kashrus. I gave a bit of introduction to kashrus in America, how things used to be done. And the question he was asked, if you recall, was, can you rely on the government? This was during the era when the OK and the OU started getting started, and people were wondering, well, what do I need the OU for? Why can't I just look at the ingredients? Isn't that what we had been doing for so long? And he says, first of all, you need to distinguish. There are certain things that, according to the Shulchan Aruch, you need hashgacha on. For example, meat. You can't have a situation where meat is left alone and there's no reliable hashgacha either. Or someone who comes in and out, there's a law about meat that's not seen. If you live in New York, you can't rely on the Department of Agriculture or anything like that to send their inspectors around. However, when it comes to other foods, you can rely on it. And if you stance where you can rely on the government, he says that, as we spoke last class, there's reasons why you can trust the government. However, he says, if you have a choice of actual hashkacha versus relying on the government, we have to follow the hashkacha. That is, without hashkacha, it would be okay to rely on it. But if you have a situation where you have hashkacha and you have, let's say, two items of food, you have to go with the item of food that has the hashkacha. And he mentions in there the Rashba. He doesn't tell us it's elliptic here, but I'll tell you what he means. Because this gets into one of the great disputes about kashrus in America. Page 60, he says, the Yadua Das HaRashba, he says the view of the Rashba is well known when you're dealing with things less than the Shear. What he's talking about is as follows. We have products that are made, and items are put into them. Tiny amounts of non-kosher food. The Note of Yehuda has a famous response on dealing with certain animal fat that was added to certain things, and he says it's bottle. So you don't have to be concerned about it because it's smaller than a 60. The Ramah has a response on dealing with it. You know, they would make certain products. They'd make, let's say, beer or all sorts of products they would make, and there'd be non-kosher. The pans would have they lard or something on it to smooth it, whatever they would. And the question came up, can you, halachically, it doesn't really give a taste to it, and it's not kosher. And the answer was that this is batel. This is less than a 60th. You don't have to be concerned, nullified. And that's a principle in halacha, that if something falls in and it's less than a 60th, you can eat it. I think today many people would say, I'm not going to eat it. It's the Pitzvah Tshuva, actually, I think, who says that if you don't eat a product that could be batel, you're considered a heretic. Because the rabbi said that you can eat it, and you're being more pious than the rabbis. So what's the problem, then? What does the Rashba say? The Rashba distinguishes between, and this is mentioned in the Beis Yosef when he deals with it, between an item that falls in accidentally, like, let's say, I'm cooking, and I drop a piece of dairy in, or the non-kosher falls in. That everyone agrees, and the Talmud describes, that's considered nullified. But let's say it's part of the process, that you put it in as part of the process. For whatever reason you put it in, you think you could, this little piece combined with 10 other things makes a certain taste, or you use it for the pan, or whatever it is. If it's part of the process, then it's done as part of the cooking process. It is not batel. That's the Rashba's opinion. If you look, Rav Avadya Yosef in Yabia Omer has a long response to him, and he shows that this is not the accepted halacha. That the accepted halacha is that even if it's part of the process, apparently Rav Henkin wasn't so sure that Rav Avadya Yosef is right, because he holds that we have to be choshesh, we have to be concerned for the Rashba's opinion. If you want to see another rabbi who's concerned, look online, the famous response of David Geffen's grandfather, Rav Tuvia Geffen, in Coca-Cola. The problem with Coca-Cola was that in the secret ingredient, before he got them to change it, there was a tiny bit of non-kosher, which would have been batel. But he said, because of the Rashba, we have to have them change it. And the kosher organizations in America follow this Rashba. Now, the body, that's really explains, if you look at his kosher list now, you can go to kosher.org, they charge you $5 now, but you can see what he regards as kosher. Basically, everything that's in your pantry now that doesn't have wheat in it, all the frozen yogurts, all the regular yogurts, all the different foods that you eat during the year, which don't have wheat in them, they're all kosher for Pesach. How could they all be kosher for Pesach? There's no Pesach hashkacha, because he says, like Rav Avadya Yosef, that you don't need hashkacha. We rely on the government, and small amounts which they use are considered batel because we don't hold by the Rashba. But Rav Henkin really was the first one to explain, and then everyone really jumped on this bandwagon, that we don't rely on the Rashba. We don't rely on the view that you don't need hashkachas. And that's really the Rav Henkin said, that the basis of hashkacha in America is the Rashba's opinion. If it was the Rashba's opinion, we would not need any hashkachas in America. The Department of the FDA, all ingredients have to be in it. There's this urban legend that less than 2%, it doesn't need to be. It's not true at all. Every ingredient needs to be in. You could make a debate perhaps about natural flavors, although people in the know say that natural flavors, really, even that would be batel. But we really don't have to worry in America. We have hashkachas, but in other countries, They don't have this situation because they don't have hashkachas on foods like the way we do. For example, if you go to England or if you go to Australia or all these places, we've spoken about it numerous times. So let's say you're living in England. The Beis Din puts out a list of kosher food products. But it's not like the rabbis go and visit these factories. They're not visiting anywhere. They're not making surprise inspections. They are making these judgments based upon ingredients, and often based upon the correspondence. They want to know if it runs the food and things like that. But there's no supervision the way we think of it. It is simply the old way of doing things, that if there's no kosher ingredients, and you're going to, non-kosher ingredients, and you're going to say, well, non-Jewish cooking, okay, there's a terim for industrial cooking, and the kalim, you don't need to be concerned about the kalim, because we have a principle that if you don't used in the last 24 hours, you assume there's no problem. And let me just read you what the London Beis Din, which is a very strict Beis Din, much stricter in matters of, let's say, conversion, all these things, than the RCA and the rest of it. This is what they put out in their booklet. It's called a kosherist booklet that they hand out. I'm reading, quote, kosher species of fish, canned or in jars, in water, brine, or vegetable are approved. In other words, you go to the supermarket, you find a kosher species of fish, it says on the package it's salmon or whatever type of fish it is, in a can, you buy it. No one in America would ever dream of buying something like that without a hashkacha. All jams, jellies, marmalades, preserves, as long as they do not contain non-kosher ingredients. In other words, you go to the supermarket, you look at it, and if there's no gelatin or anything animal shortening, you can buy any of these products whatsoever. How different is that from us, when not only do we insist it has a hashkacha on it, we'll even say it's not kosher if it doesn't. All yogurts, all frozen vegetables are permitted. All plain canned vegetables and water are permitted. That might strike you as obvious, but look at the kosher sites now. They've come up with reasons why even canned vegetables are a problem. All canned fruit and sugar syrup or fruit juice, except grape juice, is permitted. Same with fruit and vegetable juices and soda, and the list goes on and on. So we're lucky, I guess, in America that we don't, have all the hashgacha agencies, but people often don't realize that things are very different here. This isn't the way the rest of the world functions. If you go to another country, it's not like you're being lenient or you're just following a different approach, but that was the approach that everyone followed. And I wonder if it wasn't for the profit motive, if America would be like everyone else. It was the profit motive that drove all these hashgachas. So now that we have these hashgachas, we can be more stringent, I guess, not rely on the Rashba. But I don't think there's any question that it was the profit motive that originally drove all these things. Let us go on. He discusses another interesting thing in his volume 2 of his writings. Volume 2, page 175. From a number of places, you get a sense that Rav Henkin was, he had a very liberal sense. I have no doubt he voted Democratic down the line. And we see this also, he discusses the issue of rent control. We don't need to talk now about the economic wisdom of rent control. I think it's fair to say that economists, all sides, liberal economists and conservative economists agree that rent control is a bad idea in the sense that it creates shortages. In New York City and other places had rent, New York City still has it. You see declining amounts of apartments. So, but we're not talking about the economic wisdom here. We're talking about the halachic aspect. New York City has rent control. So there was a rabbi who argued that Jews do not have to be bound by rent control. What was his point? His point was that private property is sacrosanct. We have to listen to the government, obviously. We have to pay taxes and everything. But when the government does, if the government were to say, for example, that we can't eat kosher food anymore, obviously we don't listen to them. If the government starts confiscating our property, he said similarly, we don't listen to them. Torah supports private property, this rabbi claimed. It's my apartment. Look in the Shulchan Aruch, there's no rule stating that anyone can tell me how much I can charge for it. I can charge whatever I want to charge for it, according to Jewish law. And therefore, if the government comes in and says that I can only charge $1,000 a month for my apartment, I'm not obligated to listen to the government. I could tell tenants, and again, we're talking about Jewish tenants, so no one's afraid of being turned in, I guess, that I don't care what the government says. You pay me $1,000 and $200 under the table. That was what he said. And Rav Henkin argues, not true at all. That, and he develops the idea that elective representatives have the right to institute whatever laws they want for the good of the people, even if these laws are against the Shulchan Aruch. Elected representatives are not bound by the laws of the Shulchan Aruch, and if you oppose rent control, fine, vote them out of office. The whole section he has here, number 96, on Dinyan Dina de Machuta Dina. Furthermore, he says that if a case like this were to come before a Beis Din, like let's say I wanted to charge over rent control tenant, and he didn't want to take me to court because that's against, so he took me to a Beis Din. The Beis Din is obligated to rule in accordance with government law. The idea being, this ties into the notion of taxes. What's the difference between rent control and taxes? The government has the right to tax you. It's your property. It's your money. And it goes back to the notion that there's no real Jewish government. All sorts of governments. You can have monarchies. You can have democracies. And all sorts of economic systems could work in a Torah system. You could be socialist. You could be democratic. You could even be communist. There were Gedolim who supported communism. I wrote about that in the Sfarim blog. Government has the authority. It has the authority to tax. It has the authority even to take away property from people, redistribution, all sorts of things. And that's why Rav Henkin says that, and he goes on, he says that, and the reason for rent control was reason. He obviously supported it. I'm sure he lived in a rent control apartment. He speaks about how it's about, it's to helping the poor people, etc. And then he discusses the Ron's view. Rav Nissim states that when it comes to the land of Israel, there is no concept of Dina D'Mahusa. The law of the land is the law. Which has troubled a lot of people. What does that mean? There's no concept. How can you have a country? And the land of Israel is the Jewish land without Dina D'Mahusa. The law of the land is the law. Does this mean that people can just because they don't have to obey speed limits, and they can do whatever they want, they don't have to pay taxes. Hard to know exactly what Iran means, but no one concludes that that's what he means, because it wouldn't make any sense. What Iran says is that the land of Israel belongs to all Jews. The king can't throw you off the land. In the diaspora, you can be put in jail, you can be thrown off the land, because the land belongs to the government, the king, or the type of government there is. Whereas all Jews have a share in the land. And therefore, the Ron says, the Dina de Machusa doesn't apply. Rav Henkin says this only is said with regard to if you have a king who wants to tax you for his own well-being, for his own greed. In the diaspora, if let's say the king of France decided to levy a tax, and it wasn't to build roads or anything like that, it was to build himself a nice new palace, it is still considered Dina de Machusa Dina. You have to pay your taxes, because the king has the right, under Jewish law, to levy taxes even for what we would regard as wasteful things. However, in the land of Israel, it doesn't work like that. The kings do not have the right, and this wouldn't just be kings, obviously, it'd be any government, to levy taxes on the people, because the people all have a share in the land. The king does not have the right to levy taxes unless it's for the good of the people. Now, obviously, we live in democratic societies, so we all assume today we would never accept a system of government where King Louis could come and just take our tax money to build a Versailles for himself. We have all bought into this conception that Rav Henkin is reading into the Ron, that all tax money has to be for the good of the people. But in a pre-democratic system, there wasn't yet this conception, and yet he's saying Ron held that with regard to the land of Israel, there was that conception that the king of the land of Israel had to be special. It wasn't such a thing as, you know, Mel Brooks, it's good to be king, that he could just levy taxes for his own pleasure. No, it had to be done for the benefit of the population. A few more things I want to point out in Rav Henkin before we finish. Show you another aspect of his liberalism. This is even quoted by Rav Nachum Rabinovich. Nachum Rabinovich, the Goyim of our time, Rosh Yeshiva and Mali Adumim, far from a liberal. Stand on, at least in Israel. But he quotes Rav Henkin as saying that, if you think about this destruction of the Second Temple, obviously a terrible thing, but Rav Henkin points out that there's actually something positive that came out of it. And it's a step in the direction of the Messianic era, because without the Temple, we don't have the death penalty. At least we don't have it in terms of formal courts. They could do it, courts were able to do it as emergency measures, but we don't have formal courts which gave the death penalty. So Rav Henkin says that with the destruction of the temple, when we no longer have the death penalty, that's a step in the direction of the Messianic era, because in the Messianic era, we also will not have this penalty. There will be no need for it, because no one will have this desire to shed blood. And therefore, this very impulse to shed blood, which is something that God is trying to remove from us, and we see this as we're going in the direction to the Messianic era. So capital punishment is a time-bound punishment, according to Rav Henkin, that we spiritually have moved beyond. This is Rav Henkin's view. And the fact that we no longer can do it because of the destruction of the temple is a movement in the right direction. It's a positive thing that came out of the destruction of the temple. He was living in the era when there wasn't really capital punishment. America was very anti-capital punishment. Since his death, obviously, it's been a great turnaround, and it's, some like 30 states have capital punishment, and I think if you go to the Orthodox community, except if it's an Orthodox Jew being executed, they're probably among the biggest supporters of capital punishment. I'm going to have some interesting stuff on this capital punishment, Orthodox Jews and capital punishment, in a future Sfarim blog post, where I even quote an Achron who says that it's forbidden for Jews to give any money or do any lobbying or stadlanos, anything to get a murderer off of his capital offense. He's obviously referring to people who support the death penalty, because there's this idea of the arta harami kerbecha, you have to destroy the evil, and that the Jews cannot, rather than intervening, they want the government to, because he says that today we can't execute people. And this person should be executed because he's a murderer, and therefore the non-Jews have him. You have to let them carry it through. It's the right thing. So I think people will find it interesting recent events. A few other interesting points. A reviewer, Herzl Henkin, records some of his hanhago, some of his practices. One of them was in davening. Pay attention, if you go to Minyan tomorrow morning or on Shabbos, when the Chazan says Ga'al Yisrael, here we have a bracha, right before Shmona Esrei, which according to Ramosha Isserlis, we actually should say Amen for. The Shulchan Aruch says you don't say Amen for. It's a question, is it a suffix? Is it an interruption? I have another book about this. Let me see. Left it downstairs. Okay. Is it an interruption? So our practice is not to say Amen. But many people have gotten to the custom of not saying the blessing out loud. So they'll sing this tune, and then they'll say the Goaleinu, and then they'll come to Baruch Hashem, and they'll say it quietly. And Rav Henkin says, absolutely incorrect. The Chazan needs to say out loud, Ga'al Yisrael, he's the Chazan, everyone needs to hear this. And I don't know, I looked, I have not found any sefer, that is any additional sefer that speaks about how you should be quiet. And if you listen, many Chazanim do say it out loud, but Rav Henkin is very adamant that a Chazan who doesn't say it out loud is erring, is making a mistake, and you need to tell him he's doing wrong. If the rabbi does it, I don't think you can go up to the rabbi and tell him he's doing wrong. But maybe you can anonymously send him Rav Henkin. I don't know, someone anonymously, maybe one of the people listening to me now, sent me something relevant to the class. I don't know why it was sent anonymously. No name, no nothing, but... he spoke about it in a previous class. I'm not going to get into it, though. Okay, Robert. 95%+ of the land in Israel is owned by the government. But I'm not speaking about legally. Yes, the government owns the land. Reino Nissen, the Ron, says, though, that each Jew has a share in the land. Each Jew has a share in the land, even if it's not a monetary share, because not every Jew owned the land, but we all are connected to the land. It's all part of our heritage. So no one can tell us it's not ours. No one can throw us out of the land. The medieval conception was that the king, or the duke, or whoever you're talking about, he owned the property. It was his property, and you were his worked for him, and he had the right to throw you off of it. And therefore, since you live there at his discretion, you have to follow the law of the land. But no king of Israel has that right, because we all have a stake to live there. We all have a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. And therefore, the Ron says there's no concept of Dina Malchusa as it applies in the diaspora. Let's move on. I thought you were going to say something about Ga'al Yisrael. Gelatin. I mentioned gelatin before. We've spoken a number of times, but I have an interesting thing to point out, and we're going to deal with gelatin when we get to Rav Chaim Ozer, so I'll talk about it a bit again. If you go to the supermarket now, you'll see Granny's marshmallows. The only time they sell them, Manischewitz marshmallows also, but especially Granny's marshmallows, is Pesach time. And everyone buys them, I think, until 2 years ago, it said on it, kosher gelatin. Now, if you look at it, it's under the hashgacha of Rabbi Babad. He's a rabbi in America. It says fish gelatin. It said kosher gelatin. It was under the hashgacha of Rabbi Grossman, by the way, from Migdal Or. It was produced in Beit Shan. And it said kosher gelatin. Well, what does kosher gelatin mean? Kosher gelatin simply means that the chief rabbinate of Israel guards gelatin as kosher. It doesn't mean that the gelatin was produced in a kosher plant or with kosher animals or anything like that. And I'm not going to go into the whole dispute about gelatin because I want to deal with it when I deal with Rav Chaim Ozer Grozinski, because his response on gelatin is classic. And to this day, in the state of Israel, products are made of gelatin. Look, Rav Avad Yosef says that all gelatin is permissible. I spoke to you last semester about how Rabbi Sheinkoff has a whole book on this. It's coming out a new edition. He's the one that gives hashgacha on Yoplay, not Yoplay, on Danon, and on the joy of the products, and he holds that Rav Avadya is wrong. He doesn't know the Metzios, that pig gelatin is not permissible, but only beef gelatin is. I don't know how you determine the answer to that, but obviously you have the Gadol Hador, Rav Avadya Yosef, saying gelatin is permissible. In fact, from my perspective, may disagree, but I don't know. It seems to me that it's hard to see gelatin as not a chumrah. Because if in Israel everyone eats it, And if the Gadol Hador, the Posek Hador, really says it's permissible, it seems to me that it's hard to say that it's really forbidden, as opposed to being more of a chumrah, meaning that if you're in a place and you need food. And I always thought that. That was always my thought. And then I picked up this sefer just a few months ago. Yaakov Ariel, Spons of Ola Shel Torah, Volume 5. He is, David Eisen's in Israel, he can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe I'm correct in saying that among the religious Zionist population, he's regarded as the most important posek. Say the right-wing religious Zionist population. But I do think he's the most important posek. He should have been chief rabbi of Israel, if there was any honesty in that process. And I mean, you take someone like Rav Lichtenstein, he's not a posek. I think Yaakov Ariel is probably the most important religious Zionist rabbi in Israel. David's agreeing with me. And a great posek, and I have a tshuva I received from him. Two tshuvot, actually. And on page 77, Simon Hay, he says the exact same thing, that it's a chumrah, it's a hiddur, it's mahadrin, but it's not really a strict halacha for the reasons I've just mentioned. Although I wonder about what he says, because he says that if we forbid all gelatin, people would eat non-kosher gelatin. You know, we need it for the foods, and therefore we can rely on all these opinions. But if you want to be machmer, be machmer. I don't know if that's true. He says that we can't make enough gelatin or fish gelatin for products. I don't know. I mean, if you really thought it wasn't kosher, you would say just don't eat the marshmallows. His point, though, is that it really is kosher. And we don't need to give it up and say, well, since we can't make enough fish gelatin, let's not have it at all. He says it's a hiddur. Although this is a sense of, this also is an Israeli perspective, because in Israel they've been eating it for years. Rav Pesach Frank permitted it, the chief rabbin of Jerusalem and of Israel. And in America we used to eat it. And Torah Moshe Feinstein or Aaron Cutler forbid it. Speak to people in America, they just know gelatin's forbidden. If you tell them that in Israel they eat it, one of the rabbis in America on his website says that if you're in Israel, you can eat gelatin because that's the minhag, but in America it's not. So my old question was, what do you do when you're on the airplane? If you're halfway there, then you could start eating it. I don't know. But Rav Henkin was operating in an era before Rav Moshe and before Rav Aaron Cutler, and he just assumes that gelatin is okay. He's from bones, not from pigskin. So that's what I mentioned Rabbi Sheinkopf speaks about. There's bones and, let's say, meat as different than pigskin. They have different halachic status. But he permitted gelatin. And this isn't a kula when he did it. This wasn't a radical idea. This was basically the standard psak. After all, the Gadol Hador of Chaim Moshe Grudzinski permitted it. And I heard the following from Rabbi Yitzhak Hershkovitz in Israel. I'd be curious to know from Rabbi Kelman, if he remembers growing up, what Rabbi Price held in Toronto, Rabbi Gedalia Felder. Because Rav Fisher, Rav Shlomo Fisher, who's one of the great, great sages in Israel today, one of the Gedolim, he told, he said it publicly, that he was an eyewitness, that he was with the Chazon Ish once, you're talking 60 years ago, when he was a youngster, and people came to talk about gelatin with the Chazon Ish, and he refused to see them because he said that it's chutzpah for them to challenge the psak of the Gadol Hador, Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski. And if you know the relationship of the Chazon Ish to Rav Chaim Moshe, it was a very close relationship. He never would have challenged anything. But so you see, though, obviously things have changed. But this is a matter that could change back. For example, if someone like a Rav Schechter, who's the most important posek in America, if he concluded that gelatin was permitted, then people would start eating it again. It's one of these things that are in flux. Not sure. Okay. Lastly, Rav Henkin, in Volume 1 of his writings, discusses what to do about non-Orthodox Jews. And he adopts the view you'd expect. This is the traditional view that today they don't know any better, they're really not rebellious, they're not wicked, anything like that. We have to welcome them into our shuls. And then he goes and he explains, actually in a different passage, he deals with Gentiles. And he says some really fascinating stuff. First of all, he begins by saying that Gentiles today do not have the status of idol worshippers or anything like that. When he wrote this, this was a standard view. Today, with the turn to the right, and with, you know, it's very different. When you live in the state of Israel, and the non-Jews you deal with are Muslims, you're not living day-to-day with Christians. You get these extremist views that just develop that never could have ever been advocated by people who actually live in the Western world. So Rav Henkin develops that, and then he goes further, and he says that this is a terrible thing we have, that people write, he's talking about rabbis and scholars, they deal with issues of Avodah Zarah. I guess that means they give Shidorshim Binyone Avodah Zarah. They I don't know if it means they give lectures or shiurim, or they write articles on it, analyzing, the laws of the idolaters and all that. And he says that the non-Jews, people don't like Jews, will use this against the Jews because they'll assume that refers to them. Like if you give a class and you speak about all the terrible things about the idolaters, they'll say it refers to them. And he says they bring this as a proof that the Nazis were right, because look at the Jews, look how they regard everyone else. And Rav Henkin says, don't tell me, he says, don't tell me that in previous years they wrote books and articles, they discussed in detail the status of an idolater and all the things, halachic matters with regard to them. He says, because as long as Jews were being oppressed by the nations, the intelligent, the me'ulim, the enlightened Gentiles understood that the only reason Jews were writing negative things about the idolaters, like you can read Jewish writings that speak about the wicked idolaters and all that, says that as long as Jews are being oppressed, the enlightened Gentiles knew that this was only done as a way, l'chazik mamad hayadut, so that the people, l'vili pol beruchem, so that this would give the strength to the Jews. As the Jews were being persecuted and oppressed, they couldn't respond physically, so they responded through their pen, in writing. They wrote about the wicked Gentiles, how God's going to punish them, etc., etc. And the non-Jews, the righteous non-Jews understood that this wasn't meant really against all non-Jews. This is just a form of rhetoric which was designed to let off steam so that the Jews would feel that they could respond, that they were the chosen ones. Although they're being persecuted and killed, at least they're the chosen ones and all the non-Jews are going to hell, etc. Wrote Shechaviv in Yisrael, etc., etc. And he goes on and says that Vishatak Zero, when there was pogroms and persecutions, the fact that the Jews did this was a way of softening their anger. So rather, this way, Jews, instead of going out and doing crazy stuff, maybe killing a non-Jew, they could write about and speak about how the Jews are wicked and God hates them and all these terrible things about the non-Jews. And he says, what's the example? He says when they would say things like Hashem Yikom Damo, God avenge them and things like that. What does that mean? It means we're not avenging the person. We're giving it to heaven. And we are far from taking these actions. So if a Jew is killed by non-Jews, we say, may God avenge him. So Rav Henkin's saying that all the negative views of Gentiles in previous years placed, first of all, in a divine sphere that God will deal with it. And it was, they focused on these things to let steam out so that Jews would not focus on the real non-Jews. It's a way of, I guess, a form of rhetoric. And he says, the me'ulim, the enlightened non-Jews, understood this. Aval bizmanenu. But in today's day and age, when many people don't follow the Torah, and they actually become, they follow Gentile ways, and many, when everyone was religious, Jews were parted one way, but now you have Jews who live among Gentiles. You don't have the same distinctions. He says, if we speak, the non-Jews today don't distinguish. They don't distinguish between these Jews and those Jews. And anyone who speaks negatively about non-Jews, Dani Motor, they regard him as a rodef. So if the Jews today are not living in the ghetto, they're not being oppressed, they're living in all sorts of places, and they live among Gentiles. And therefore, if the Gentiles, even the good Gentiles, they hear Jews using this sort of language, like we have to wreak vengeance on the Gentiles and all these terrible things, they don't have the same assumptions they did years ago. They assume that Jews are evil, wicked people, and they regard them as akin to murderers. After all, if a group of Jews are talking about how we hope that God comes and strikes down these people dead, which you found in early prayers, but if you do it today's day and age, he says, it'll be a terrible thing. And then he says, the whole Kativa mitpashei techef, the whole olam. That's our Rama Farsalim and Makabalim. He says, anything you write today is spread immediately around the world, and we can multiply this a hundredfold with the internet. Anytime these idiots on Matzav and Yeshiva World News and VIN, they write these comments, these are immediately spread all over the world. In a second. And the whole world picks up on this. Remember the book by fucking Sadia Grama, which was featured in the Foreword, his terrible book, this guy in Lakewood. He says, and this is immediately spread by people. And the non-Jews, they don't spread the good stuff that we say, just the bad stuff. And he says, we have to remember this. And be very careful about this. So why is this so significant? It's so significant in the sense that he recognizes you can speak differently in a different era. In today's day and age, things that Jews used to say, prayers they used to say, ways they used to speak, it's simply not acceptable. I mean, in the ghetto, when Jews were being oppressed, they spoke negatively about Christian religious figures, about Christian religion. I mean, things that today are just unacceptable. If only for purely utilitarian reasons. But I obviously think it is for reasons, for basic moral reasons. And in the footnote here, he goes further. He says that he speaks about people who, they make a chul Hashem, he thinks it as. We have a principle, for example, that B'nai Noach, non-Jews, are killed for violating the Noahide laws. So you have people saying things like, well, we know that a non-Jew is obligated to Noahide laws even if he steals a small amount. So people were saying, a non-Jew who steals, he steals an apple, he has to be killed. I mean, crazy stuff like this. And Rav Henkin says it's not true at all. He sees it as a real chul Hashem. U'latzareinu rabim mishtabshim. Many people make this mistake. Go bring Sarah b'chazal. They speak badly about Chazal. That is, they give these interpretations that make Chazal look like barbarians. And he explains, what does it mean? That unlike Jewish courts, non-Jewish courts are not bound by the same rules. They don't need two witnesses, just like courts in America. They can use different types of evidence. They don't need warnings. And they could make any law they want to make. If they want to make a law like English courts used to have, that if you steal an apple, you're killed, they could. They have the authority. Jewish courts don't have that authority unless it's Hora'at Shah, emergency measure. Non-Jewish courts have that authority. Shaharashut B'yadim Nimrotzim. Then he says, Avavadei Sheroi Lahem, L'chokei Chukim Yisharim, Gein Arzo Sabris. He says, they have the rights. But they shouldn't do it. Those are bad laws. They should be like America, to make good laws. And laws, Shirakapidat Rabi Makim Bonshin, to follow what the people want. And you could Efshar Ishtamesh Bishar Mineonshin, use different types of punishments. But with Torah Gamrei, or free them altogether. So you don't need, although the court has the right, they can execute people. All these things. But they don't have to. They can do whatever they want. It gives them that, there's more leeway for a Gentile court than a Jewish court, and he sees this as part and parcel with saying things that make the rabbis look terrible, people who he feels just don't understand Jewish law, and write about it, and make terrible Chil Hashem. You know, the Chil Hashem we have today, not just for all the criminals and everything, take a look at some of these websites, look at some of the comments, first of all, the ignorance. People who, a little knowledge is dangerous, especially on the internet, that people write, is just unbelievable. It makes Judaism not just look bad for the non-Jews. I think plenty of Orthodox Jews, they see this and they're turned off. They say, well, this is what traditional Judaism is, then I don't want any part of this. And there's any number of people on these sites. In fact, I know someone I used to be friends with, Rabbi Hirsch is on, he remembers David Kelsey, he's a blogger now, in which all he does is attack Orthodoxy, and you have many others, and it's not Orthodoxy that they're turned off of. they were turned off by this some sort of crazy fanatical type of Haredi orthodoxy with that Rav Henkin is speaking about, and now they're very anti-orthodox. Had they had a very different approach to some, there's no reason to think they wouldn't be in the fold. They're told all sorts of things. Some of them, it's when they first learn about science, they're turned off. But others, the lists are endless. It's almost 100% the anti-religious people you see online. People with all these websites, Failed Messiah, who is Chabad or quasi-Chabad, all these people who have an axe to grind against orthodoxy, they don't come out of the modern orthodox world. They come out of the extreme. They come out of the Hasidic world, the Haredi world, because they were so extreme on one side, then they go the other way, they go so extreme. But their arguments are always the same. That Judaism was never something humane, it was never something full of love, it was all about, the chinuch they were given was all about hatred, hatred of non-Jews, hatred of the group that they were not part of, hatred of the modern Orthodox. It was always negative, it was always destruction. There was nothing, and many of them had found their way to the type of Judaism and the other forms of Eastern religions because they're looking for something. They grew up in such an environment, and it's unfortunate. But that, and Rav Henkin, you see a reflection of this, I believe, right there. Okay, I just have one little more point with Rav Henkin, but let me look at the comments here in case it's relevant. Let me light up my screen a bit so I can see better. Rabbi Ari, well, I know Ari Zivotofsky too. He was in my show a few months ago, and he even showed pictures of me and him when we were in Egypt together. We went to Ethiopia together, to Egypt together. So he wrote about that. Yes, it is a misconception. Okay, so there we have Menachem. Thank you for pointing it out. I said that I did not know of anyone who permitted that. I would be curious to know, though, whether it was actually more in the way of a limud schus, like an Aruch HaShulchan type of justification after the fact, or if the authors they cite their lechatchila say you should do that. I don't believe there ever was a posek last couple hundred years who told the people not to. I believe this developed on its own because they were told not to say the blessing. And therefore, chazanim, in order to prevent the people from saying the blessing, which it wouldn't be so terrible, he said the blessing, it's the Ramah. But in order to prevent people from saying the blessing, they started saying it quietly. Maybe I'm wrong, but I find it hard to believe that the rabbis ever, to me, it's more of a chazan sort of thing. And look, chazanim do all sorts of things, minhagim. Well, we just had Parsha Zachar. For the first time in my shul, we spoke in the past about customs. The Gabbai told everyone to stand up for Parsha Zachar. So not only to repeat it, now we have to stand up for it. So this will become the new minhag. And I believe probably when we come to Parsha Kitetze, I hear there's a minhag in certain shuls. Now you read that twice. And these are minhagim that just develop on their own, and then they immediately take root. And the final thing I want to point out to Rav Henkin, about Rav Henkin. I meant to mention it before, but I'll say it now. I spoke about his fear of Israel being destroyed and opposition to state because he was, I'm not going to say he's a peacenik, but he thought that was the way to save the Jewish people. You see this also in his article in Hapardes. If you want to check it out, it's Sivan 5719, speaking about the Warsaw Ghetto Revolt. And he says, obviously, we don't judge these people. Partially, they were in circumstances we can't imagine, but we also shouldn't put them on a pedestal like this is the way Jews respond. That it was suicide, and the Jewish approach is the quiet approach, the approach of shtadlanos, behind the scenes. That's the traditional approach, not protests, not fights, not military action. So you see someone who really very much reflects the old style ghetto mentality. As I said, I meant to mention that before, but with this, I come to the end of Rav Henkin. If anyone has a question or comments, I'll stop for 2 minutes, and then at least I'll introduce Rav Eliezer Berkovitz for about 5 minutes. I'll hold off here for a minute. Comments about Henkin. Okay, well, let me just go for 5 more minutes, and then at the end we'll have time to deal with any questions. Screen here. The next figure, Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz. He looks very different, obviously, than the rabbis we've seen so far. But if you saw a picture of Yisrael Moshe Chazan, we don't have a picture. I'm sure you'd be surprised how he looked. If you look at many of the Sephardic rabbis, beardless and what they're wearing, they don't look like what we've accustomed to think when we see the Ashkenazic rabbis. He's a fascinating figure. He's a significant halachic figure, although he was a failure in terms of halacha for reasons we'll talk about. YCT's journal, Milun Chaviven, just came out yesterday. And in there, I published Berkowitz's response about entering a church, which it'll be online hopefully this week. He wrote shuvos, he wrote important things, but he was a failure in that his approach was never accepted, so we will deal with it, although his life was devoted to two things, halacha and theology. Theology, he really was a success, and his significance continues, and as long as people are dealing with theology, they will be focusing on him. For example, this is a classic book that we Faith After the Holocaust. So there's two aspects of Eliezer Berkowitz. And these books like this, his theology books, would be kosher for all segments of the Orthodox world. It's his halachic writings or not. So let's begin at least with the biography. But I think there's probably people listening to us, if maybe there's some Skokie graduates or people who knew Eliezer Berkowitz. I did not know him personally. I know two of his sons. Third son lives in Brooklyn. I don't know, but I know he has two sons in Israel. One who teaches Talmud Chacham. The other, I believe, is a professor of physics. Avraham. I met him once, though, to interview him for Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Weinberg, but I don't know him. He was born in Romania in 1908, and his early studies were under Rav Akiva Glasner. Akiva Glasner is the son of Shmuel Glasner, the Dorei. Spoken about numerous times, we'll have classes about him. You can learn all about them. Just plug Moses Glasner. Look on Wikipedia, there must be a link there, because Akiva Glasner has a son, David Glasner, who works for the Federal Trade Commission, but he also is a scholar. He has a website devoted to his family, the Glasner family, which was an important Hungarian family, the rabbi in Kloisenberg, in Cluj. A Zionist figure, a very significant person. And his son was Akiva Glasner. The Dor Revii, the father, had a unique approach to halacha. You don't see this in the writings of the son, although I think perhaps it was there, at least orally. In any event, Eliezer Berkowitz himself would have a very unique approach to halacha, and I like to think maybe it goes back to the Dor Revii. He received smicha, actually, from... His first smicha was from Akiva Glasner. Akiva Glasner ended up in Switzerland, where he died in the 1950s. David Glasner is actually the grandson of Akiva Glasner. Berkowitz then travels to Berlin, where he enrolls in the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. This was not uncommon. He had many people from Eastern Europe, from Central Europe, who came to enroll in the Rabbinical Seminary. Many more wanted to. They were not permitted in, because just like YU today, you need a college degree, you needed to have an advanced, the equivalent of a high school diploma, the Abitur from a gymnasium. So you had people, going back to Hildesheimer's day, who would just show up in Berlin and want to be enrolled in the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin because they wanted to be more modern rabbis, they wanted to also have a secular education, and they were not permitted to enroll because they didn't have a secular education. It's no different than YU. You can't have people coming just without a secular degree. It wouldn't be the sort of rabbi they want to produce. There have been exceptions they made in the past where they felt people were autodidacts. But in general, they won't accept someone. YCT won't accept someone without a college degree either, although they've made, to my knowledge, two exceptions. One person who came from yeshiva, had on his own a significant secular education, and someone who had almost finished his college degree. And there are reasons in each case. I see it's already 10 o'clock, so let us stop here. Next class, we'll deal with a very interesting biography of Eliezer Berkowitz and his early years. but let me see if we have comments and questions on what we've done so far today. We did a lot today. Next class, I'm going to show you one. I got to all my, at the beginning of the class, I only have one more point I want to show you, something interesting regarding Rav Soloveitchik, and I'll wait till next class for that. We have two more classes after this. Okay. No, he was never offered a job in a yeshiva. Never offered a job. To my knowledge, he was never offered a job from a yeshiva. Your impression, various blogs, were from the Hasidic groups. I believe they most were from the Hasidic groups. You have lots of rebels, people rejected Satmar and Bells and Bubov. They have an organization, they have a whole website, and there was a movie made about them, that Pearl Gluck, I think she did the movie, and there's a whole group, and almost all of them, you listen to them speak, here they're dressed, some of them now have tattoos, and they're in these biker t-shirts and all, but you listen to them talk, they sound like they did when they had to pay us and everything, because they grew up speaking Yiddish, so they'll never actually sound like a normal American. It's actually very sad. Because these are people, these are not like the Litvisha people. If a Litvisha guy, 20 years old, wants to leave, he at least has some secular education, he has a high school degree. These are people, I don't know how they get there's a law in New York, but they go to schools like Bubov and everything, and they don't really have any secular education. They don't follow the laws. They have maybe an hour of English. These are people who will never be able to make anything of themselves. And I'm sure many don't leave precisely because of that. In the community, they're given jobs, menial labor jobs, they can blue collar jobs, but outside they're never going to be able to make anything themselves. At least in their community, they can drive a bus and pack boxes, and that's accepted. But outside in the wider world, they have no education, no possibility. So I think most of them are Hasidim, but not exclusively. I know some, but I agree with you, most are. And I don't think it's an accident. They were the people the most extreme. But at the Torah in Motion conference 2 years ago in Toronto, we had someone who came. He drove in from Niagara. I'm not going to say the name because many of you will know him. His father is one of the big rabbanim in Lakewood. He grew up in a completely Litvish environment, spent time in yeshivas in Israel. And he is as far removed from religion as you can imagine. And he also is complete with tattoos and the earrings and the whole bit. He told me, we got into a nice conversation because he read the Weinberg book and he wanted to connect with me. So we spoke and he told me that his mother doesn't let him come to Lakewood. And I said, well, why don't you take off the earrings and why don't you wear long sleeve shirts? Can you imagine, can you blame your mother for... So you also have it in the Litvisha community also. And there's a whole organization. Rabbi Abadi's son, Chaim Abadi, has a whole shul. He has a website, Minyan Shalanu. Of these people in Lakewood who are not fitting in. So these are people who are still in the fold, but not fitting in. But there's plenty of dropouts also. Yeah, the Haredi, I mean, it's the same thing. Now, the problem is that it's not an elite movement. How can you have a society where you tell every single person they have to do the same thing? You're always going to have dropouts. We have in my town, West Orange. When the modern Orthodox drop out, they become non-religious or reform or conservative or something. The Haredim drop out, many of the Haredim, not the Hasidim. When a Satmar guy drops out, he just goes off the deep end, maybe. But when a traditional Litvisha guy leaves the Haredi world, more often than not, they end up in Teaneck or West Orange. They become more modern. Because they don't want to reject everything. They just don't want to live that certain life, or they become Ner Yisrael. It's a progression. See if anyone else has any other comments. His close student is his grandson, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin. He did not have, Rabbi Rabinovich had some sort of connection to him. What he had was people who would come to ask him shilas and people who liked to be in his presence. But he didn't give, he had Rav of a shul, but he doesn't have students in the sense he has followers, people who lived on the east side who were very devoted to him. and who davened with him. Every day they davened with him. And yeah, he gave classes to them. But in a sense, when you're thinking of students, like great Talmidim at yeshivas, that, no, these are balabatim. We're very devoted to him. He didn't have students in the sense, no Rav in Europe had students the way you're thinking of it, unless he also had a little yeshiva, which is why Rabbanim in Europe would make it part of their contract that the community would have to support, let's say, 10 guys. So they'd open a little yeshiva. Because otherwise, they'd just be dealing with balabatim. And they give a shiur, but those are not followers. Those are not students. Rabbanim, who were just Rabbanim in shuls, never had that. They never Rabbanim in cities. And Rav Henkin was not a magid shiur. But Rav Henkin was still from an era where Rabbanim figures. And the Rashi Yeshiva were not as important as Rabbanim. Today, if you look at Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, they only appoint Rashi Yeshiva. They've come to the conclusion that Rashi Yeshiva are the most important. But traditionally, the Rashi Yeshiva kept out of these matters. They were not involved in politics. In fact, in Sobotka Yeshiva, the Rashi Yeshiva couldn't have any involvement in Aguda or anything like that because they had to be above the fray. They had to be able to speak to the Mizrahi, the Aguda. Today, it's very different. Okay. Well, there's more question. One more question. The Amsterdam Minhagim are very, very old. Many Minhagim all over Europe are old. There is a volume of response I have, actually three volumes. There's a Rav named Evers, Rafal Evers. And he records all the different Minhagim in Amsterdam. These Minhagim go back hundreds and hundreds of years, the Chacham Tzvi and before. And by the way, if you're in a shul like Amsterdam, I'll tell you Basel. I'll just give you an example. Basel has a kahila there, nowhere near as old as Amsterdam. Amsterdam had an Erev in the days of the Chacham Tzvi. But Basel is about 150 years old, I think. And in Basel, and there's great Torah scholars who are rabbis in Basel. In Basel, they repeat words. In Shmon Esrei, you can get the details. Email Ari Folger. He's the rabbi there. Folger. And he wrote about this, how they repeat words in Shmon Esrei. So today, of course, everywhere you go, they won't let you repeat words in Shmon Esrei. But in Basel, where the Minhag has been the same for 150 years, and they've been doing this every generation in front of great rabbis, the Minhag never changes. Someone's going to come in and say, there's something wrong here. Repeat words. So you have a place like Amsterdam, very old Minhagim, and they'll keep these Minhagim. If I'm not mistaken, they have a very interesting Minhag about when they start the fast on Yom Kippur. They started later, maybe when it ended. There was a Rabbi Schuster, who was also a Rav in Amsterdam. He published a little volume, Edus Aaron it's called, and he discusses something interesting in there, if I'm not mistaken. But if you want to see the details, it's in the volume by Rafal Evers, three volumes. And there's another volume. I mentioned it. Lekha Kemach HaChadosh, it's called. It was Minhagim and Other Things of a Rav in Amsterdam. In my last Svarenbog post, or the previous one, where I dealt with calling intermarried people up for an aliyah, I quoted there that the Minhag in Amsterdam was to call them up, I believe, don't call them up for the first seven aliyahs. So yeah, places like Amsterdam have very, very old Minhagim. So you're saying they did not say Gal Yisrael out loud. That would be quite interesting. That would be a good proof. If you go to the Sephardic shul in Amsterdam, to this day they do Birkas Kohanim on Shabbos. This goes back to Shabtai Tzvi. This is an innovation of the Sabbatian movement, but they continue that minhag. The one minhag they don't do in the Sephardic shul. Although I don't know, David S. is on. I think he thinks they should bring this minhag back. The minhag in the Sephardic shul in Amsterdam was always that the Ashkenazim sit in the back. It's like the women in the Haredi buses. The Ashkenazim were not permitted to go to the front of the shul. They had to sit behind, in the back. So all proud Sephardim, I think, probably they want to get back to that because they know what the Ashkenazim, how we screwed up so much of Judaism. But in Amsterdam, that minhag they got rid of in Amsterdam. They let the Ashkenazim in. You can write to people who live there. You can get all... Why would he have brought Basel Minhagim, though? He's not from Basel. He came from Germany. Are you sure it was Basel Minhagim? He comes from an old family. It goes back to Altena and other places. So these are no doubt German Minhagim. And don't forget, Basel is part of German Switzerland. These are German Minhagim. These are German communities in Could be. I don't recall whether he served there. It's maybe. I don't think so, though. Okay, well, hold off any other comments, questions. Please look it up. And if you get anything, Bill, about the Menhagim of Amsterdam, you know who you can ask. You know who knows the Menhagim very well? The chief rabbi. Rabbi Avers is a rav there, a posek, the chief rabbi of Amsterdam, the chief rabbi of Holland. It's Rabbi Rabag, the Triangle K rabbi. He is the chief rabbi. He goes there every month, every other month for a week and a half, for 2 weeks. He is the chief rabbi of Holland. Why is he the chief rabbi? He served there as a dayan in the 1970s, a number of years. In fact, his son, Reit Zvi Rabag, who's the rabbi, and he was in Staten Island, now he's in Long Island. You can listen to his shiurim on yutorah.org. It's a big Talmud Chacham. He gives all sorts of interesting shiurim, and I wonder, you know, he's going to be, in another 10 years, he'll be one of the main rabbanim in Woodmere, and by then he'll have, or Cedarhurst, wherever he is, by then he'll have taken over the Triangle Gay Hashkacha. Is the Vod of the Five Towns going to say that the Hashkacha of one of their big rabbanim, huge Talmud Chacham, is not going to be reliable? We can wait and see. Yeah, I find it hard to believe. But and he was born there, the Tzvi Rabag. So Rabbi Arya Rabag served there as a dayan, and while there, he wrote the famous response about the Amsterdam Eruv. They had to make changes in the Eruv, at the reasons, and he wrote the response, updating the Eruv, which that the event of Tzitzeliezer created a big machokas with another Rav in Amsterdam. In any event, he comes to America, becomes Rav of Young Israel, and one of the Young Israels in Brooklyn. But when the position opened up, they liked him so much, they brought him over. In Europe, I can tell you that people think of him as like a great Rav. I don't know, Adol, but top Rabbanim. In America, people have a different view because of the Kashrus. They don't. But in Europe, he's really on a pedestal. Woodmir. Okay. Very good, everyone. Okay, we have two more classes where we'll focus on the late, great Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz. Look forward to seeing everyone next week.